Hello, my name is Bill Cummings, and you're listening to Show Me Magic, a God Is In The TV recommend show.
Greetings and welcome to Show Me Magic special with Emily Breeze, with Mr. Jim Orton.
Hello.
Myself, Bill Cummings, and Emily.
Hiya.
Hiya. How you doing?
I'm very well. I've just finished work and I'm ready to talk shit about other people's music.
Oh, well. It's always a laugh, isn't it?
It's what we're here for.
So what have you been up to, like, on a musical front recently?
We've just finished a tour and released an EP called Second Rodeo. Thankfully, the gods of Radio 6 have still been smiling upon us, which has been fantastic. And I'm now going to write the rest of the album.
Excellent. And you've been quite a creative streak, haven't you? You've had a few albums the last couple of years.
I'm thrilled that it looks that way. I'm actually not very prolific at all. I create the illusion of efficiency.
It feels like.
I know everyone says that. No, I'm really a really slow songwriter. I think part of the illusion is that there was a 2-year pandemic in the middle where times, so it seems that I was quicker than I have been.
Does everyone like have a backlog? Had like written loads of stuff during the lockdown, but they had nothing else to do. So there's just literally a backlog of music that then people drip feeding out over the past sort of 2 or 3 years.
Some people did. I remember everyone saying, "Oh God, I missed music so much," and I thought, "I fucking don't." Really amazing break from the grueling horror. But I am enjoying being back in the saddle now. It's been great.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably just a bit of a break for some people as well. I mean, they say they missed it, but they probably actually enjoyed
it. There was a limit, though, wasn't there? It was got to about 18 months. So I was just thinking, oh, I was climbing the walls a little bit.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean on a music front. I could see how that could be good. I mean, sometimes I'd like to take a break from all the things I do, especially the social media side of it. It's just crazy. But
we didn't really get an opportunity, did we?
No, we started this in lockdown.
We started this during lockdown instead.
It was good though, because obviously you couldn't really talk to people outside of your immediate family and stuff. So and they don't know of all these weird little bands that I like. Sorry, what was that?
This is your lockdown baby.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Playing together for the kids.
4 years old. Going to school soon.
It's true that. Yeah, and was it a recent single you had in 1997? Is that really? Yeah. Really like that one. And I think I've got your last album as well. In fact, I think I've got both your albums.
You've reviewed everything I've put out, Bill. So I'm very appreciative of the support. And it's a great magazine as well.
Oh, cheers. That's. Do you know what? That's the only reason we do it, I mean, obviously we enjoy it, don't we, Jim? We enjoy writing about music because we love music. But, to people to say, especially when we're at Focus Wales, it's like, I was saying to somebody, it's the only time I feel like I'm actually like anything. Because we've got like lanyards on, I have saying God Is In The TV on it. And it's like, oh, you're God Is In The TV, blah, blah, But usually in everyday life, it's just like, nobody really understands what I do.
Yeah.
Or cares. So it's nice to be appreciated.
It is that utopia where everyone sort of knows who you are, so I think it's quite funny.
Yeah.
So you want to have your name laminated? Is that the...
Yeah. The
No. Do you know what? I actually
go round with a constant lanyard.
I actually enjoy life without being known and stuff like that. I wouldn't even say I'm anything special. It's just that because I was doing speed meetings, you know what I mean? It's something out of my usual... I don't usually do that in life. People sit, you're queuing up to meet me and stuff like that. Ask for my advice. It's like, well, am I that important? Have I got any advice?
As you said, Bill, you're a big deal. You're a big deal.
I'm not. not at all. Ridiculous, no. I never wanted to, the idea of being famous actually frightens me, really does. Anyway, you do a bit of, did you used to work in BIM? Is that right?
That's where I was this morning. I still work at them. I have unbridled enthusiasm for my students. I love all of them. And unconditional positive regard for what they're working on, which means that when I leave, that part of me is extinguished and I'm dead inside. And I was thinking, I don't have anything salaciously bitchy to say about any of the songs you've sent, because I like all of them. I think they're all really good. But a lot of it, it just feels like more music, doesn't it? Have you got to that age yet? Where you're so immersed that you're like, yeah, that's great. Yep, more music. Okay.
Sometimes does feel like that. I do agree. I think you especially because obviously the way things work now, you're literally bombarded and that you can't really escape it. And it's, yeah, sometimes you've got to try and find that really special thing. And sometimes, yeah, you say it's good, but is it really amazing?
And that's completely subjective. And
yeah, exactly.
I think it's just the way sort of how we consume things has changed possibly as well. Yeah, I was talking to Goat Girl, name dropping and stuff, you know. And they, Lottie, the singer, was saying that she's had to really sort of concentrate on trying to listen to music, you know what I mean? Streaming is kind of, and I think, you know, changed our relationship with it, you know. So in some ways, like doing this, it's like, it's probably sometimes the most in-depth going into on some of these tracks than I would, you know, normally. So it's quite good in a way. Especially with this one, because we delayed it, didn't we? So we've had a few months with some of these. So.
I had detailed, beautiful notes. This made you weep for the first one that we had.
Sorry about that.
And well, no, I quite like it if people are a bit flaky, because I'm a bit flaky, and then nobody feels guilty, and it's actually a wonderful way to be. These I've listened a little more quickly this go around, so it's very much a first response.
Fair enough.
Well, that's how it normally works anyway for us, isn't it? We sort of have it a few days before, and then so it's always a bit of an instant reaction to it, which now is what people don't seem to like as well. When people start talking about how music is reviewed, it's now, how can anyone possibly review something after listening to it once or twice? So how was it
how
ever?
How else is supposed to do it?
How else is, you know, oh, sorry, we can't review anything for 6 months because, you know, Bob in Chepstow doesn't like the fact that someone had something slightly negative to say about an album. But, you know, that's always how it's been done. People listen to a CD, listen to a record, and gave their opinion. So why is that? Should that be any different now? Just because
there's much more of a vicious stan culture as well if you're writing about certain artists online and stuff. Like, unless it's like, you know, not 10, then you're going to get criticism, you know, as a writer, which kind of ruins the kind of idea of critique, really, I suppose.
Do bad reviews still exist?
Not as much, but people often take it like personally, as if it's mean. Yeah. We've been quite lucky with this because, like, there hasn't been many times where, apart from Sleaford Mods, no, there has been many times where people have taken offence by it. I've had a couple of emails like from saying, "Oh, you know, one of your speakers didn't like my stuff. I'm upset," you know. But apart from that, we try to be a little bit balanced, you know.
They're probably throwing darts at pictures of your faces. They're just too dignified to get in touch.
I'd love to think that's how it's happening. I really would. It'd be amazing.
Well, Sleaford Mods, didn't one of their fans like draw a schoolyard cock and balls on Tim Russell's face?
Yes.
Gave him a bad album review.
Well, I got like Twitter shit from Sleaford Mods fans for giving one of their albums that compilation one with the toilet on the front too. 10. That was a few years ago. Generally speaking, when I've done bad ones like Coldplay, it was always gone down quite well when I've given it like 1 out of 10.
They're like the shy Tories, aren't they, Coldplay fans? You never meet any of them, but they're everywhere.
Yeah, they won't come out and attack you for it. No, it's quite nice. But yeah, I've done a few sort of out of order, big slatings of certain small bands, and probably shouldn't have done them, really. I wasn't in the right mood for it, and then, yeah, we got shit from that, didn't we? Let's get taken down.
I think sometimes it's a bit easier to, if it is somebody like Coldplay, because they're big and you could sort of puncture the hype or whatever. Mm. Whereas if it's somebody smaller, maybe it's easier to be, you know, you have to be a little bit careful in terms of being constructive, you know?
You do, but I think also what you're doing is you're putting music out, you know, into the ether for people to listen to and people to have an opinion on. And I think if you can't accept that, then you're probably in the wrong job.
Do you know what? Sometimes it's better to get like a 1-star review than it is to get a 3-star review.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you saying that from the Voice of Experience, guys, or is just from a journalistic angle?
Well, I work in PR as well, so from my experience, it's just like whatever gets coverage, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to have a good review, isn't it?
Of course. But like, yeah, I mean, there was that one that I did of that one and that my review got slated and came back and had a right go. But the guy then had about 3 times as many listens to his stuff online than before. So if I'd have given it like a 7, I doubt anyone would have cared. But instead, everyone said I was wrong, listened to his stuff, and he got more listens. So he won. So
he should thank you.
Exactly. I mean,
we grew up in the era of Melody Maker, didn't we, and stuff like that. So we're used to people getting a good slate in.
Yeah.
And it can be quite entertaining. It's an art form, really. I haven't written many, but when I have done, it's more because I want to make more of a wider point about music. Because I did one about Lewis Capaldi, and I kind of made the point that, like, he's sort of more representative of
personality.
Personality pop stars, you know, who are in the social media era, you know, as much as his music, as has anything to do with his music.
You knew him. You know him better than you do his songs, don't you, really?
That's right. Anyway. Let's crack on. So what's your first track you brought for us, Emily?
The first track I have brought is by an artist called War Against Sleep, and the song is called Jingle Jangle. I want you guys to tell me what you think about the song before I speak about it, actually.
I'll go first. I enjoyed this one, actually. Is the guy's name Duncan Fleming? Is that right? Very 60s, and I like the sort of marriage of orchestration and his vocals, slightly off center. I got a little bit of a Lou Reed, Scott Walker, Elvis Costello type of feel from it, and but with like a bit of a cut tongue in cheek twist. Mm-hmm. And when I was listening to it before on my walk, because I do, because I'd like to listen to on the walk, the guitars as well was sort of reminding me, I don't know, of like Bowie kind of guitars as well. I'm trying to think of his name now. Who was on Heroes? Oh, my brain's gone dead today.
It's not Mick Ronson on Heroes, is it?
No, it's the other one. What's his name? Anyway, doesn't really matter, but it would help if I knew. Let me have a look.
Googling's cheating.
I've just forgotten his name.
Well, I was getting kind of like while you're checking, Bill, I was getting a kind of sort of like a dark western type sort of feel, creaking saloon doors. I think it's got a bit of a Ennio Morricone going on about it, I think.
Definitely.
I don't know. It sort of feels like singing. I was still getting that kind of like Alex Turner crooner kind of thing going on as well. So I don't know whether that's his normal singing voice or whether he's kind of putting that on, which isn't a problem. It's kind of good to have sort of different personas as far as I'm concerned. And I thought the name might be a sort of cheeky dig at War on Drugs, but he formed before, didn't he? So quite like that, would it?
Alex Turner and War on Drugs by some time, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, no, I'm not, he's not obviously aping it. It's just that kind of crooner thing. I do like that. I do like the way people do that. I don't have a problem with the way the Arctic Monkeys bent sort of more laterally. But I really like this. I say, I'm getting, definitely that Scott Walker thing. I agree with Bill. I agree with Bill on the Scott Walker thing.
Robert Fripp.
Robert
Fripp. King
Crimson.
King Crimson. Can't speak today. Just the kind of way it was kind of decorating the tune. And like a couple of your other ones, it reminds me of sort of like something that would be playing on a David Lynch film or something.
Yeah.
Like some old bloke, like you didn't even know who he was, like a character on a rocking chair, you know, singing about the jingle jangle. I could just imagine that. Do you know what I mean?
Do you listen to the lyrics?
Kind of, the jingle jangle. That's all I remember.
You missed the whole Whore of Babylon.
Okay.
Oh, no,
These smutty aspects of this song.
Okay, go on.
Well, I won't go into any more on that, but the reason I chose this song is it's not nepotism, because I believe that Duncan Fleming's towers above all of us as songwriters. I first saw him playing Bristol probably about 20 years ago in this little art house cinema called The Cube. And he eventually joined my band. He used to play keyboards in my band.
Oh, nice.
I just revere him. He's above, certainly on a par to or above all of the greats, such as Scott Walker. There's a lot of pulp in there as well to me.
Yeah.
He was signed to Fire Records for a little bit, actually.
Oh, right.
And this is the holy trinity of song. If you want me to love your music, it's got to be funny, sad, and sexy. And that this song hits that triptych to a very high standard. And he's never had, he does it all for fuck all. There's no backing to it. There's no money behind it. He's so cool that he doesn't even need to be clapped at. He's not even trying to be successful. Just prolifically creates these really strange masterpieces.
Yeah, I've got, actually in my notes, I did have lounge singers of the 50s. Yeah, I did hear that, yeah. But I like the sound of it, yeah. It almost sounds like, I want to say, like, sort of quite lo-fi, but in a way, it's got hi-fi elements as well. It's probably made lo-fi, but it's trying to sound hi-fi kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. In his attic. Yeah.
I don't know if it's the lo-fi. It's almost like it's made to sound old.
Yes, yes.
In that way, almost like on purpose to you know, to have that effect on the way, you know, where it's produced, the way it's recorded. I agree with Emily completely. That kind of, it's got to be funny, it's got to be sad, and it's got to be sexy. And there's quite a few people doing that. One of my favorites is someone like Father John Misty, who does that really well as well. And it obviously doesn't sound like him, but that's kind of that bent of being, of doing humorous lyrics, but also like adding the kind of tragedy of the human spirit, basically, as well, sort of channeling in all of it.
I think he's quite uncool to like, because he's like another like white guy with an acoustic, he even refers to that in his own tunes.
Absolutely,
and he's quite beautiful, so sort of seen as the enemy. But his first three albums were a huge influence on me as a writer. Really, like you said, really, really funny and detailed and profound.
Yeah, I mean, I think his fourth as well, God's Favourite Customer, is that's got a hell of a lot of brilliantly hilarious lyrics, and it's very much a concept album about, I mean, completely, obviously, he's the persona of Father John Misty is obviously not him, and that's kind of his like on stage and artistic persona. So it's basically about him being on like the John Lennon Lost Weekend, but in New York, on the opposite way around. And he's basically written this whole thing about him being this like alcoholic, drug addled mess in New York, and his wife begging him to come back. And it's all complete nonsense, but it's hilarious, but also quite tragic as well, about how he writes about people who get themselves into that kind of position as well. And it's, yeah, he's a genius songwriter. I think, if I was a songwriter, I think I'd be pretty. I mean, he inspired me to write about him quite often. So, and you know, I haven't seen him live for a while now, but I've seen him quite a few times. Yeah, no, I love that kind of. You're not a big fan of how, so are you, Bill, of the way that kind of almost like affectation of the way someone sings, that they should sing in a real, in their own voice. But I prefer if they have that ability to do that and be a bit different.
I don't know about that. I mean,
you're not a big fan. You don't hate it.
What, Father John Misty?
No, in general.
I know what you mean, but if it is a convincing character or they're doing a style, I can enjoy it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Problem with that. It's just, with Father John Misty, I haven't heard enough to, like, I think I've actually seen him and I can't remember. I think it was at the Six Music Festival.
Because
I saw Cat Power before that, so I was like, yeah.
Anyway. But anyway, yeah. Yeah, I love that kind of, that way that someone does, that puts that kind of persona on stage and decides to have a pseudonym.
Well, I do like that. I mean, obviously, Bowie is one of my favourite, you know, artists.
Yeah, no, that's true. Of course.
He did that a lot. And not to say, I just think sometimes it can be a bit obvious or a bit of a, when it's an obvious pretense, if that makes sense, a bit see-through. Sometimes.
I suppose if the pretense is also obvious and then he then is self-deprecating about that and the whole fact that he's doing this kind of thing. And yeah. even mentions his real name in his own songs, which is quite funny.
Well, I like Lana Del Rey, and she does that, really. Mm-hmm. She's playing a character, really. And I do like, because she's sort of, even though she's playing a character and playing a sort of a, an image, she's sort of delving into her own personal ideas as well. And yeah, you could still do that and sort of like character songs and, yeah. personal stuff. And I'm not against it. I just think maybe we were talking about Jack White. Maybe that's why.
No, I suppose, yeah.
Because I was saying that he just strikes me as quite like fake, but in a sort of annoying way, like sort of trying to be more interesting than he probably is.
Bit like Johnny, a
bit sure like Johnny Depp or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, what are we going to give this out of 10? I'll give it 7.5. 7.5.
I will. Yeah, I was going to give it 7.5. That's what I written down. Yeah, 7.5.
Classic one.
Hey. Yeah. Of course.
Fair enough.
Absolutely.
So you've chosen it, for sure. To you, Jim.
To me. So my first choice of this pod is a band called Ain't, and it's Awe. Before, this lot were turned on to me by my mate, G, who said there's been quite a lot of like hype around them, but it's one of these bands I hadn't really heard of. And they were on a bill that probably we might have gone to, but ended up selling out at the Social in Oxford Street. But yeah, this is their own one and only single so far. They're from London. They've sort of done a bit of support. They've generally been supporting sort of bands, and they're not particularly well known, even on sort of to medium size. So there's made up by a few of them: George, Ella B, Ed Randall, Anna Hannah Baker Dart, who's the vocalist, and Chapman Ho, which is a brilliant name, on bass, and Joe Loxton on drums. Yeah, this is, again, after talking about this before, this is a pandemic originally written song, and it's just taken a while to come to fruition and gone through a certain amount of changes, apparently. And it's the singer Hannah has reinterpreted the lyrics to be loosely inspired by the legend of the Welsh. Lys Helig. Do you know about this film? Lys Helig?
No. It's a new one to me.
It's a medieval Welsh kind of like legend. But yeah, I just really like it's kind of, to a certain degree, your post-punk that's very popular at the moment. But there's I don't know, I kind of like it when someone has got a kind of a historical, mythical kind of bent on lyrics and writing more about something either ancient or, you know, fictional or something like that, as opposed to sort of writing another song about how dreadful everything is in the world. I mean, because obviously it's very easy to write a song about how dreadful everything is in the world, because it is. But yeah, I kind of really like how the intensity of this lot. I don't know much else about them, really. They're sort of brand new. I put it in our tracks of the week a couple of weeks ago. It feels like we're being kidnapped and taken across a stormy sea on a rowing boat, manned by Vikings, off a wet sandy beach, salt stinging the lips on the way to their ship to be taken away.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I'm hopeful of good things for this slide. Say, there just seems to be something a little bit different that it's hard to put a finger on, and hopefully they're going to sort of branch out to sort of different sounds as well. But I'm kind of into that kind of noir, darkish, gothic kind of side of post-punk, like bands like Slate and things like that. So, yeah, I really like this.
It's interesting when you say London, because I was getting America, and when I read up on their bio, it says from both sides of the Atlantic.
Oh, okay.
So I think some of them might be from America. Yeah. Her vocals were giving me sort of American vibes. Anyway, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I see what you mean. She might be from America. They might have just formed in London, so she might be American. I haven't got that, so...
I did like it, and it surfs elements of, like, art rock, post-punk, post-hardcore even. Yeah. Sort of, like, smashes open, like, with times... Different, like, shifting time signatures and sort of embracing guitar assaults, I put. It reminds me of sort of elements of, like, Sonic Youth, Kim Deal, kind of delivery, obviously.
Yeah.
But with almost like a bit of Out the Driving, I was thinking, you know, the way it sort of shifts and the sound of it. But obviously the guitars have got a bit of a shoegaze thing. So it's got a bit of everything that's kind of like hip at the moment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like it. And I read that it was about sort of like bristles with the frustration of politicians who let you down and stuff like that. Because it was on about lies and promises and stuff like that.
Like I said, it was originally written by the guitarist, George Ellerby, but then when Hannah Baker Darche joined, she kind of reinterpreted lyrics. So, yeah, it was written in the pandemic about a lack of faith in those in charge. So, yeah, I can imagine that's probably why they sort of reinterpreted it a bit.
I wouldn't say it's anything particularly, like, you know, innovative or new. But it's good at what it does, and it kind of takes a lot of elements that are like kind of hip at the moment. You know, the only thing I would say is Ain't, as I said, is like really hard band name to. Because I don't think they've got any socials or that I could find anyway.
Yeah, they should have put a V in it, shouldn't they?
But it's like it's untaggable. So like, you know, that's a
I know what you mean.
But then some people don't seem to care about that stuff anymore. So I don't know. What did you think of Emily?
I thought it was excellent. Yeah. In the era of everything being post-punk, whether it actually is or isn't.
Exactly, what does it even mean?
It's starting to bore my tits off now.
I agree, yeah.
Never-ending young wave of post-punk bands. But I didn't think that about this band. I found them really likable, actually. They reminded me of like some kids in a rehearsal room. Mm. Really take it really seriously and they really mean it and they haven't grown calluses over their vulnerable, beautiful hearts yet. And that made me feel quite on their side. I also thought of Washing Machine by Sonic Youth with Kim Gordon's vocal.
Yeah.
And a bit of like Proto Martyr as well, who I really like. Anything with jingly, jangly, dissonant, wiry guitars, I will love. I just wanted more of the chaos. I wanted them to be more violent and more chaotic, but they can do whatever they want.
I mean, hopefully that's to come. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I did that proto-master thing. It's kind of like that sort of bubbling intensity that can just sort of completely overboil at any point. And that, yeah, you sort of felt like with that, with them, and that's their opening gambit isn't actually going to then like take off. It's going to wait until the next thing or even the one after that for it. Because, yeah, you feel like there's this simmering rage, which I know a lot of bands have, but it's better to sort of work their way up to that.
And it's kind of the delivery is quite sparring, isn't it? There's like her delivery is quite sort of stream of consciousness, I prefer, than, you know, speaky, whatever. And then there's other elements are like kind of hollered and, yeah, that's why I was getting a bit of a post-hardcore thing, a little bit, but made more interesting by their attack of it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good.
Cool.
Okay, we're going to give that because we better get... We've done two songs for 40 minutes in.
We're out of time.
I'll give that an 8. Jim?
Yeah, I was going to give it an 8.
8.
Cool.
To you?
To me, is it? It is Sunday, brackets, 1994, and Tired Boy. Bill themselves as like coming from across the Atlantic. So they've got elements. I think the singer is from America, maybe New York sort of area, I believe. And then the rest of the band, or other members of the band, are from this country. So yeah, it's an interesting one. Andy Von Pitt put me onto these, and that obviously it's got the very much of a dream pop kind of element to it, which is kind of something I do love sometimes, as you know, Jim. What I like about this, and they've shown it on their EP, which has got, I nearly changed the track actually, because they've got another track that's really great as well. But they say they're trying to conjure up the bittersweet nostalgia of 90s romance films, and you can hear that. And it's a funny track because on the face of it, it's a very pretty melody and a kind of bittersweet melody. But when I actually dig down into the lyrics, she's talking about sort of like, she's sort of talking about a character she sort of mocks, but is also besotted by in equal measure. So there's this idea of like, you painted your nails to look like a rock star, you sing in a band and your voice is like nails down a chalkboard. You know? So there's, yeah. I like the honesty about it, but even though it's delivered in quite a nice way, almost like a 90s sort of the Sundays, Cranberries, that kind of thing, but it's got that kind of twist. And that is something that they do on other songs as well. They've got one called Stained Glass Windows, which is about like being a Catholic and being ashamed of like being in love with somebody and stuff. And
Yeah, she said it's about being in love and ultimately jealous with someone who's so careless and clumsy, yet somehow everything falls in place to them, for them. So it's kind of being jealous of that kind of that we all know that person, you know, that guy who's just like, you know, always lucky, you know. But yeah, just it obviously builds into sort of a trembling chorus. I really like her voice. She shows off her voice on other tracks on the EP as well, and the glowing guitars, and yeah, it does that sort of dreamy pop thing, but in a, yeah, in a really, you know, sort of really well realized way, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about them, just hearing their other stuff as well, because I think also, as I said, it's that balance between something that's really poppy and kind of enveloping and nice to listen to, but it's also got a bit of a kick to it, because sometimes with, you know, dream pop, it can be a little bit on the nice side. Do you know what I mean? On the nice side. So I like the fact she just says you don't give a shit, basically. You know, it's almost like she's taking the, I don't know, people like Lana Del Rey and people like that, who, or Billie Eilish as well, she's taking some pop elements as well, of just singing about what you think, you know, and just singing about you know, how you actually feel, you know. So yeah, it's very widescreen and sort of, yeah, very the kind of thing I like. Jim, what did you think?
Yeah, well, I really like this. I hadn't heard them before. I'd seen the name and I sort of assumed that the Sundays had decided to like give themselves a date, because there was obviously someone else that was giving themselves a similar name just to distinguish themselves. But I mean, obviously when you look at them, these are some young people in a really promising band. I really like the fact that they sound like one of my favorite bands of the past year on the dream pop side of things, Bleach Lab. I think they're quite similar to them. She doesn't sound like Jenna, but that kind of, like, so sometimes with dream pop and even some of the stuff you bring on, Bill, we've obviously had this discussion before, I just don't find enough substance in it. I find it like washes over you a little bit too much, and it's quite easy to sort of ignore almost. I don't want to be horrible about it, but so this seems to have a bit more to it. There's a bit more substance. Like I say, the lyrics are quite funny. She's got a good, a more interesting voice, and it's not just wispy. Sometimes there's that whispery kind of a bit too, yes, kind of
ethereal kind of.
Well, I like ethereal stuff as long as there's something more to it that's kind of got.
I know what you mean. There is a, yeah, like in all genres, there is a cliche, isn't there? There's tropes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but. No, I really like, I just like that the songwriting seems really strong. I kind of like their aesthetic as well. There's a certain amount of mystery to them. I kind of like that when people are being a bit too, you know, front and center on social media and stuff, it gets a little bit sort of saturating, a bit boring, but they seem to have a bit more mystery to them. And I think certain bands are getting like that now. I think they might be thinking that being a bit too, you know, constantly in the gaze of people, that it gets a little bit boring, people start to ignore them. But yeah, I want to check out the EP. I hadn't really seen, I only got this from you a couple of days ago, so I'm going to check the EP out now. It's on my list. Yeah, I'm quite excited to listen to the rest of it. I'm going to listen to that on my way to London this evening.
Emily, what did you think of it?
I thought that the lyrics were fucking excellent. Yeah. I don't think she's just saying what she thinks. I think she's a really clever songwriter. Yeah. And it's funny and bitchy, but she's also sort of digging at herself. And I wrote down the same ones that you did about the voice, like nails on a chalkboard, and those video games you play are extremely violent, but I don't mind. And it's really three-dimensional. It's actually like excellent lyric writing, and the structure and the chords are beautiful. Everything is beautiful. Perhaps a little too beautiful.
Oh yeah.
It's very pretty and it sounds expensive. And I think it'll be really popular in the world of the Lanification of all things. I like Lana Del Rey, so I don't mind Lana Del Rey. Yeah. She's very referential herself. I don't mind that being smudged all over everybody and everything, because it's taking in so many other cultural reference points. I wanted to pull her voice. I thought her voice was sinking into the track, and a very pretty voice. And I would have pulled that up somehow in the arrangement and done some bolder, more memorable moves musically. But yeah. that actually isn't what makes people successful. So nobody should listen to me.
No, I know what you mean when you... I didn't mean she just says what she thinks, as in, and she just rips it out of her diary and she doesn't think about it. I mean that she's not afraid to have a go back, if that makes sense, you know. Yeah. And it's very well constructed lyrics. I didn't mean it like that. I meant that sometimes you listen to things and you could tell the lyric is a little bit, you know, it's not being
honest.
Yeah, honest, or like just punchy. And I like that it's punchy, you know, and it's got, you know, I don't give a shit really, you know. It's like, I just like that. And there's an element of that with lyric writing, isn't there? Who else was it who does that quite effectively? Well, there's a few bands at the moment. Dry cleaning, maybe, you know, that kind of thing where you just, you know, you're saying what you think, but it's obviously well constructed as well. Sorry, I didn't mean to say like it's just literally ripped out of a diary.
I just like how
what I'm trying to say is she's not afraid, because a lot of, you know, younger artists, not to be condescending or patronizing, it sounds like it, but they can be a little bit, and even when you interview them, and they can be a little bit, I feel like they're holding it back a little bit. And I like with her, especially hearing the other songs as well, she's just, you know, she's given it two-footed sometimes, which I like.
Sometimes they feel like they have to do that, otherwise...
Yeah, play the game. But it's funny, because I don't know if it is, like, they're quite a new band, so I would be surprised me if they were in, like, an amazing studio or anything. But it does sound quite, polished. Expensive.
It's an aesthetic choice, isn't it? You can do a lot with a little.
You can, yeah.
In terms of recording.
Yeah. And, yeah, hearing the rest of the EP, there's more layers to it and stuff. But yeah, I could see from your point of view, it is still within that dream pop world of it's quite nice. You know, that's what I was saying. It's that juxtaposition, isn't it? Most dream pop is quite nice. It's nice by nature, isn't it? It's sweet and nice. And
I feel like sometimes with certain dream pop bands that you think that they probably could like descend into a bit more of a kind of like, shoegaze, but kind of like noise pop, sort of that thing, when they can just kind of, they could quite easily descend into that.
Yeah.
And I think that you think that maybe they might be able to do that.
There's a couple on the EP that are more, do you know what I mean, a bit more punching. This is like the first thing they released. This is the first single they had out. They're quite big on TikTok, you know, but there's the first one they had out, and there are other ones that are a little bit different again. So, like the one about the Catholic Church, which I nearly picked, is, you know, again, it's still pretty, but it's got a bit more spite to it, probably. I just like the lyrics. I like that kind of surprising juxtaposition between something that is pretty and tuneful, and then suddenly it'll hit you with a lyric that's kind of like you didn't expect. So I suppose Lana Del Rey does that, and you are right. It is very much influenced by people like Lana Del Rey, even a bit of Taylor Swift, I think, a bit, on the rest of the EP. Okay, what are we going to give this? I'll go 8.5. Jim?
7.5.
Fair enough. In terms of like fucking talent, it's really high. It's like it's like a 9. It's brilliant. It's so well done. It's totally impressive. In terms of how likely I would be to put it on, it's a 7, which is also high.
That was fair enough.
It is good. Back to you, Emily.
To you, Emily.
Oh.
And again.
I picked this song because it also falls into the important three elements, the Holy Trinity of funny, sad, sexy. It's got a really amazing rhythm section, and it's about, it's not that clear what it's about, is it? But there's a feeling of everything being utterly futile and pissing in the wind, which is tragic, and I love tragedy.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's really fun. The first few times I listened to this, obviously we've had this done for quite a while now, as I was desperately trying to put my finger on who he sounded like. And I basically made a list that included Brian Ferry, Bob Geldof, Willie J. Healy was someone a bit more contemporary. And actually, the more I listened to that the past couple of days, the more I think he really does sound like him. And that's a good thing, because I really like Willie J. Healy.
So, yeah.
He's quite funny, isn't he? Because he's kind of just a bit, his name's kind of a play on words. His name's Nick Russo, isn't it? So it's just slightly changed his name for a sort of for persona, put on stage pseudonym. But yeah, it's just, again, it's like one of those bands that's got, you know, the artist that does that kind of, like you say, it's that three things, like the Holy Trinity, as you said, is he's doing that kind of funny, tragic, but really well written sort of 60-ish kind of pop song. But this has kind of got a bit more of a, I don't know, more of a contemporary edge. This is more lo-fi, I think. I don't know. Mm. I do like it. It's weird.
Do you know what it reminded me a little bit of? If it's Lou Reed solo.
Right.
Because when I got into Lou Reed and like the Velvet Underground, I bought like a Lou Reed like greatest hits, as you do. And I'm laughing at that because I've since bought all his albums and stuff. It's just often it's your gateway, isn't it, buying the greatest hits. I think it was like greatest hits of Velvet Underground and Lou Reed. But like his solo stuff has got like a bit more of a sort of fractured edge to it. And I was getting that from this. Yeah, they're kind of like black, pitch black streams of consciousness through a very cinematic sort of atmospheric sort of sound. The only thing I would say about it was I was a bit like Jim. I was struggling to get my hands on what was like really standing out about it personally.
It's the groove, guys. You're right. Such journalists. It's this absolutely...
Probably if I heard it live, yeah, maybe.
Head nodding, slow groove, which I am just about to probably rip off that that approach to rhythm.
Yeah, it did remind me a little bit of your stuff. Yeah, some of your stuff, yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm probably going to remind you of it.
The rhythm, like the percussion, yeah, like you said. It's just... a little bit sort of disorientating, but I did like it. And it's got that kind of, slightly fractured element to it. Like, you know, like I said, Lou Reed solo, I was imagining, you know, I was kind of thinking of.
There's a lot of, I stayed up all night one night and listened to every single Lou Reed solo album.
Yeah.
They were all on Spotify. And how much of it would I listen to again? Not a lot of it. And I'm the biggest fan of Lou and the Velvet Underground. But I mean, there's a lot of. Do you mean more like Vicious, Walk on the Wild Side, or the early stuff?
Yeah, that kind of thing, or just that idea of he kind of deconstructed kind of
maybe
ideas
like
of rock, didn't
of
he? Yeah, just that kind of idea. I don't know, just that kind of looseness of it and the way he delivered it. I don't know, it was just giving me Lou Reed vibes. But I know what you mean about his solo stuff as well. Yeah, it's very much hit and miss. There's some good stuff, but yeah. A lot of not very good stuff as well. But there was a point. It's just like, you know, when you get into an artist, you're like, just like one of everything they've got, you know, like listen to it all. And then you're like, yeah, I like Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. Have you seen the film about, it's a documentary, really good, a few years ago about Velvet Underground.
I've seen a lot of films about the Velvet Underground. But then which one?
It was all like footage from the time. It's very good. It's very well put together. Anyway,
has he just like disappeared? Because I sort of did a bit of reading up about him, and obviously there was an album after the album this came from called SP, and he was the way he was talking about the character is becoming unlikable. He's succumbing to what he's taking his own. Has he like ditched it? Has he disappeared? Or?
Well, as a deeply shallow Spotify listener, I don't know. I listened to loads of his other stuff, which was all beautifully, with that really warm and sounding production. But the songs didn't grab me in the same way that this one did. And this is the horror of streaming, where you just sort of add the one that you love immediately and move on. So I actually don't know.
Oh, fair enough. No, I just wanted to be reading about him. He sort of almost feels like it took him a long time to do this album, apparently. And then he's like partially... It almost feels like he might be abandoning the persona. I don't know. Maybe he's out doing some stuff and gone to a different one. And we just don't know. Yeah, be interesting, though. I do like it. I need to check out that album that it's from. Is it In Heaven, did you say?
Yeah.
In Heaven.
He's like Reggie Perry, and he's gone off to the sea.
He has,
changed his clothes, come back as a different artist.
That's such a brilliant people, only us three people have already said.
Do you know what's weird about that as well is what was his name? Len Rossiter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I actually interviewed Martin Rossiter once, and I didn't actually realise he was related.
Are
they? You know, from Gene?
Yeah,
because somebody sent me a question. I asked for questions like for him, and somebody said, oh, something about your uncle, you know. So I asked him, and I was expecting him to say, oh, no, it's not my uncle. So, you know, blah, that's just a myth. And it was his uncle. He's like, oh, Mark. Oh, Leonard. Thing is, though, with Martin Rossiter as well, he sounds like Morrissey. Like, it's like being on a phone call with Morrissey. So it was all very weird anyway.
That's really good indie trivia. I didn't know that relation.
I had no clue. And I asked him, like, as if straight up question. You know what I mean? Joke, in a way. He was like, oh, how's you, you know, what was your relationship like with your uncle? And he died quite young anyway, so. But it was, right, yeah. A bit painful.
It's one of those ones you forget that you knew that fact.
Yeah. Anyway, what are we going to give this? I'll give it 7, actually. I quite warmed to it on my walk a little bit more.
I'm going to give it an 8.
Cool.
It's an 8 from me.
Cool. Back to you, Jim.
To me. My last new track of this pod is by The Joy Hotel, and this is called Black Balloon. Yes, The Joy Hotel. This is this is a band that Andy Von Pipp, our producer, turned me on to. I think he had him dabbed them as track of the week from their previous single called Jeremiah, which is really, really good. They're a septet from Glasgow. This is the second single to come from their forthcoming debut LP called Ceremony, which is out in July on So Records. But I really like how there's this certain thing about certain bands from Glasgow, and I'm not 100% sure if they're definitely from Glasgow, because there are a few bands that seem to form in Glasgow, because I don't know where they all go to the art college or something, and then from different parts of the country, but then decide to stay and then form bands. But this is like this, yeah, quite a lot of them that form this, that kind of big sounding sort of almost like certain elements of chamber pop. There's quite a lot of strings. There's orchestral moments to it. There's a good female male sort of dueling vocals and stuff like that. And it's just quite sort of big and anthemic. And I wasn't expecting that when I sort of got this. I don't know why. I was almost expecting something sort of the opposite, calling themselves The Joy Hotel and from Glasgow. I was expecting some Duer Scots people and it being quite dark. But
what are you trying to say, Jim?
Well, they're all miserable. No,
you're thinking of Rhapsody Nesbitt, are
you? I was in Glasgow late last year and they're all really lovely, actually, so that's just not true. That's just the stereotype that we all get for Scottish people, don't we? But and they're really good. I just really like how, this is... Apparently, this is one that they've re-sort of recorded and rewrote when they were doing the album at Rockfield in Monmouthshire, the infamous Rockfield. And apparently, in essence, it's a story about someone losing their baby and helping that person find their way back to health, both physically and mentally. So it's kind of got that, again, as Emily was saying, that's got that kind of genre of being tragic, but then also some funny elements to it and being like a really great pop song as well. So yeah, I'm really interested to hear the LP. I would keep meaning to actually see if I can get myself an advanced copy of it to listen to, a stream of it from their PR or something. So I need to do that. But because it's really good. I really like both their singles. So yeah, it's got this kind of, yeah, it's sort of that kind of slightly psychedelic side of it. But it's, yeah, I just think it's quite uplifting as well. So. Yeah, I'm really excited about the album.
What do you think of it, Emily?
I think the songwriting is phenomenal. Like, they sound like they really know what they're doing, and that it's like highly creative, and it takes a lot of skill to communicate something that creative in such an effective way. I love piano ballads, and it doesn't have the funny of the Holy Trinity.
No, it doesn't have the funny.
This is a fucking tragic song. And it's really brilliant that I love it. We don't often hear these stories from women about their bodies and things. It doesn't exist in music a lot of the time. And I think that's just fantastic to hear. Do you know, so I saw the Baby's Shoes, and you know that the reference from that. It's the attributed to Hemingway. It's a 6-word short story. It's known to be the saddest story. For sale, baby shoes never worn. So
Idols do a song, don't they? Did a song based on that as well, about his own child.
Who did?
Idols. So Joe Talbot wrote a song about that. Yeah, I think that's on the second album. Right. Joy. But it is basically, baby shoes never worn. Yeah, yeah.
It's really tragic. It's got loads of gravitas. The first line is amazing. You woke up dream sick in the afternoon. It's just so rich in imagery and like done with an immense amount of words. I think it's incredible songwriting.
Interesting. Maybe I need to read the lyrics because it sounds really different to what I was thinking of. But then maybe I didn't read the lyrics. I was just basing it on a tune. Do you know what I mean? I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I really like the arrangement of it and the orchestral part of it.
Well, I thought that might be up your alley. Do you want to see at the moment, Bill?
Yeah, because I'm writing about 90s strings in the 90s, the use of them, and, you know, the good and the bad.
Because I thought that it kind of had that sort of...
Yeah, it does. It reminded me a little bit. Do you remember that band Uberman?
Yes, yeah.
Shorty band. Wall and all that.
Do you remember a band called Electricity? They were very ill-fated. They had the really good single. And they were very much kind of like that orchestral
sound.
Yeah.
I did like it. And I like the sort of interplay of the vocals, you know, the male and female vocal. Yeah. But I need to read the lyrics again because I wasn't getting any of that from it. And obviously that's a main part of the theme of it. So I'm a bit unqualified, really. I'm just going on the sound, really. It reminded me a little bit of like, a touch of Belle and Sebastian, just because I want to say, you know, maybe Belle and Sebastian's more sort of hi-fi moments. But it's interesting with Belle and Sebastian, because I was talking to a friend of mine. I actually liked all their stuff when they were recording in the church, the first two or three albums.
Yeah, yeah.
When they actually went more hi-fi, they kind of lost some of that kind of, I don't know, bit of that charm of...
possibly.
I like this. It is uplifting, and I'd like to, you know, delve more into the subject matter of it, because I find that, especially from a female perspective, as Emily said, it's like you don't hear that very often. So I think that's important, really. And, it's a good song.
Cool. What do you want to give it then?
I'll give it 7.5.
Emily?
For the songwriting, the weight of the songwriting, I'm going to give it a 9.
Cool.
I was going to give it an 8.5. So it's good someone has had it more than me. Cool. So your last new track, William?
Yeah, you're taking over the presenting, eh, mate? It's all right, it's fine. It saves me talking all the time, doesn't it? It gets boring. This is somebody I just interviewed, actually. Her name is Georgia Ruth. It's from Aberystwyth. And this new one has got the strings provided by Griff Ab Alwell, who does Griff Rees's string arrangements. So you can hear that a little bit on this one. And also, I thought it was quite apt because I mentioned that it reminded me a little bit of Francois Hardy. I just really like this one. It's very different to her usual sound. And she was telling me that the whole album was inspired by a period when her husband was unwell, seriously unwell. Mm-hmm. And it fits in with the whole album. You probably wouldn't get that from this song because this is a kind of more about escapism and stuff. But but the whole album sort of goes into this whole narrative of like driving and like the idea of going through a dark period and then there's light at the end of the tunnel, etc. But I've always really liked her voice, and I like she says that it's influenced by Americana, and I can definitely hear that, the Glen Campbell sort of thing. It's quite a theme in this podcast because, again, use of orchestral. And I asked her if she'd like had an orchestra, but she actually said that the way he does it is he'll have two or three players and then he'll sort of double it up. So that's quite a good way because, you know, in my research, I found that it can be quite expensive to have, a full orchestra these days, you know. But in the 90s, it was different because they were throwing money at people, you know, going, you know, stick an orchestra on that, you know, because it was like fashionable at the time. But I just really like the sort of, I love the sort of the feeling and the atmosphere it evokes. There's kind of those gently lapping guitars, sort of bouncing percussion, sighing horns. The horns give me quite a French, I don't know if it is a French horn, but yeah, it gives me quite a sort of a French feeling, French pop. And I just really like it. And then there's a kind of an open road feeling and a feeling of escape and freedom. And like the idea of driving, you know, you don't know where you're going, that kind of escape, even though I don't drive, but I get that idea of, you know, wanting to escape, you know, the the problems in your life and stuff. It's a thing that's been in films, especially. And she does mention, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and stuff like that. But yeah, listening to the album, it gives me more context as well for what she's doing. There's probably more darker songs on the album. This is much more of a sort of a breezier element of it. But I've always really liked her voice, and I think this is, I said to her, it's probably going to be in the running for the Welsh Music Prize as well, probably, because she's won it before. So, but yeah, she has. But yeah, it's something quite different for her. I like that idea as well, because I'm not really into like Americana generally, like Americana in the way that, like, you know, Uncut often has Americana, you know, that kind of idea that it's has to sound this kind of way and it's stuck in its sort of, I do like people like Neil Young, and I do like people who come out of that, who were influenced by American sound, but they're not stuck in the box, if that makes sense. But I like the way it's sort of not too stuck. It's quite a light arrangement. That's all I'll say. Anyway, what did you think of it, Emily?
Well, you're not making it easy for me to be
horrible,
which I'm not remotely interested in doing. But
it's all right.
It's not as much fun, though, is it? If I was in the pub, we could pick other things and be vile about everything. I'm in the pub. But it's absolutely brilliant. It's like I think there's a real sadness in the song. Actually, I don't think it's just easy breezy. It's got a sun-drenched sadness with this lovely kind of California golden haze over everything. Yeah. The band, the rhythm section are incredible, and the band, the whole arrangement and the production is so accomplished, and all of it supports the song, which has really sort of clear, a beautiful theme. I love songs with cultural references. I love it if people pull in things from, we've got Thelma and Louise in there. It's amazing. I followed her on Instagram. I listened to it.
Really? I've known her for years because she played the harp a lot on her earlier stuff.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. There is still a sadness in her voice even, and the lyrics. I do agree with that. I suppose I was talking about the, in terms of the arrangement, it's got that kind of breezy feel to it, though, isn't it? Even, yeah, it's again, the juxtaposition that we talked about on other tracks, you know, it's got that juxtaposition. Yeah. But I know what you mean. I suppose what I mean in context compared to what I've heard the album, you see, so there's a bit more darker, even more darker elements to it.
I liked how long it was as well. It's like, I think it's about 4 minutes long. Yeah. And I hope they've done a radio edit, because it's pure Radio 6 fodder as well. That could be.
Think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Often with Welsh, this is why I bring on something Welsh every time, because I'm from Wales and I'm trying to champion that, you know, the artists we got here. Sometimes there's a glass ceiling, though, you know, with Welsh artists, apart from people like Guano, Griffries, Kate Le Bon, that kind of thing. But for everybody else, it's quite a glass ceiling sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. I've worked with a few. So anyway, Jim, what did you think of it?
I really liked it. I liked it. The subject matter is, say, quite sort of, there's melancholic elements and sad, but I thought it sounds really warm. So those horns, trumpets and stuff at the beginning.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
It kind of reminded me of Aldous Harding. As well, not necessarily her lyric, her way she sings, but that, the way that sort of sounds, her last album, Warm Chris, but also the album before that as well, which is Designer, which I love, it's a brilliant album, but that kind of sound, it's kind of quite sort of loungy, but but almost, you know, kind of like a slow jazz kind of way, but with the way that she sings as well, it's kind of reminds me a bit. Whilst she's not anywhere near as abstract as Aldous Harding, they've got that kind of way of being sort of quite engaging, the way she sings. No, I really enjoyed it. I would like to listen to the rest of her LP when it's out. But yeah, it was weird. It's that juxtaposition of it being quite warm feeling. You know, there's a warmth to it. I don't know way you use a better adjective. But whilst it being kind of sad, like I say, it's about her husband. But yeah, it's good.
Yeah. No, I think there's a theme with a lot of the tracks on this that got juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Okay, what are we going to do? I'll go 9. Yeah, why not? Why not? 9, love that. Jim?
I was going to give it an 8.
Emily, what are you saying?
Well, it's this ridiculous concept, isn't it, to give it a number out of 10.
I know.
Yes, absolutely.
We're not taking it seriously.
No. I would give it a nine.
Totally arbitrary.
It's a nine. I don't know what I'm taking the point off for, but it's a nine.
Cool.
Let's talk about some classic tracks.
Let's talk about some classic tracks. Okay. What was your first one, Emily?
My classic track is called Forever, and it's by Peter Drake. And I chose this song because I cannot resist late 50s, early 60s, velveteen lounge music. I will like anything that sounds like that. And it songs like this, or things like Sleepwalk by Santo and Johnny, or they've all been recontextualized through popular culture. So I believe that they're written to be sort of warm and romantic. And then through the lens of the dreadful cliche influence, David Lynch, who's we're just all under the cloak of David Lynch. Yeah. This is so amazing. And even films like American Wealth in London, where they put in songs like Blue Moon, they've been imbued with a fantastic creepiness. So they're like equally dark and luxuriant. This song's actually had a moment on TikTok, which I was annoyed about for a minute because I thought it was like a precious little gem. And then I realized that actually I want everyone to be listening to amazing music and that it's fantastic.
Yeah, why not? I enjoyed it as well. And it's funny you mentioned David Lynch because I put, reminds me of a song that could have been played in the hotel lobby in Twin Peaks.
Yeah,
it's got that, hasn't it? Almost like elevator music almost, but in a more sinister and like, you know, much more well put together way. Yeah, it's quite a 60s sort of loungy, romantic sway to it. And yeah, I don't know. The backing vocals, I've written this ages ago, so I don't know what I was thinking. The backing vocals remind me of Mr. Sandman.
Yeah.
I
suppose it's that 50s kind of, you know, barbershop thing. And I put it's had a, has an underbelly, like you said, of something more sinister and heartbroken. Yeah, I'd never heard it before. And yeah, very intriguing little oral delight. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? I prefer his real name, Roddis. Roddis Franklin Drake. That's a much better name. You should have stuck with that.
Right. Well, in the 50s, everyone had a stage name, though, didn't they?
Pete 60s. Drake. Yeah. Pete Drake sounds like something you see down the pub, isn't it? Oh, yeah, Pete. You know, Pete Drake.
John isn't exactly an amazing name, is it, really?
But it's still better than Reg Dwight, isn't it? Let's be honest.
I don't know. It's about the same, really. I don't know.
Maybe. But, yeah, because he's like one of the, he was like one of the most sought after like lap steel, pedal steel guitarists, wasn't he? Okay. The sister, because he played on "Lay Lady Lay" by Bob Dylan, "Stand By Your Man" by Tammy Wynette, and he's like he was inducted to the Hall of Fame in like 2007. Although he died in about 88.
Done your research?
Yeah, I did. No, because I didn't know the name, and because it's weird because it's also when you look into it, this song doesn't sort of mean what you would have thought. Because as you say, this is quite, you know, country and Americana and stuff. And I can still see why you play on stuff like Lady Lay and Stand By Your Man, because it's kind of that sort of feel to it. It's just not a name I'd ever heard before. But yeah, I thought that's one of the first things that struck me, that you should have just stuck with Roddis. Roddis Drake. But yeah, no, he's quite a famous pedal steel guitarist, but for playing on stuff that you wouldn't necessarily have realised he played on necessarily.
I didn't know any of that, you brilliant nerd.
That's why we got Jimmy, you know, do the research. I don't do much research.
Well, if I don't know that much about someone, like...
Yeah, no, it's fair enough. I do sometimes.
I always like to check it out just to see what they're about.
Well, it helps having so many research, yeah.
Yeah.
It's good if at least one of us has. Make it look like we know what we're doing. So I'll be giving this one then... it's a hard one to score, actually. I'll give it 8.5 because it's so different. And yeah, Jim?
7.5.
It's from some sort of intergalactic realm where numbers don't exist.
Yeah, fair enough.
Sounds fair.
Numbers don't really matter anyway. It's just arbitrary, isn't it?
To me?
Yep, to you, Jim.
So my classic this week is from the 1990s, the best decade, and it's Drugstore with El Presidente. A friend of mine sort of reminded me of this a little while ago, and I, you know, when someone tells you, "Oh, you know this song by Drugstore Old President," and I was like, "No, don't think so. I recognise the name." And then it's like, "Yeah, Tom York's on it." I said, "No, don't remember Tom York." And then as soon as you put it on, it's like, "Oh my god, yeah!" And they're like, "Watch the video on YouTube." It's like, "Oh yeah, I watched this like loads in the '90s." It's one of those ones where you get this blank spot, you know, blind spot in your brain. It's like, but yeah, I kind of really like it when like Tom York was doing something slightly less sort of abstract and avant-garde and a bit more just like straightforward. And it's one of those songs that I think everyone found quite interesting in the '90s because it's kind of got that slightly flamenco sort of feel to it, and it's kind of a bit interesting. And the fact that, you know, it's about killing a president, obviously, everyone would like to get on board with over the past 20 odd years. But it's one of those. I listened back to Drugstore as well, and it's not necessarily that indicative either, is it? But
no, they're more sort of dreamy pop,
shoegazy
element.
It's just one of those, you know, it's just those ones that you completely forgot about. So I thought, well, I'm definitely going to have to choose it as a cult classic then, because it's one that probably not many other people remember. It's not one of those ones that ends up on compilations and stuff like that, or that many people even remember. Maybe even Tom York doesn't remember doing it. I don't know.
No, I remembered it because I interviewed her a few years ago. So she's a very interesting person. She's from Brazil originally.
Isabel
Monteiro. And I like the way their voices work together because they're both quite, they twist their notes, which I like, you know, there's kind of a twisted sort of note on each, they sort of bend and twist the melody as well. It's a reworking of a track that appeared on the Drugstore album, dedicated to former Chilean president Salvador Allende, who was ousted in a 1973 coup, as you said, in which General Pinochet played a key role. There you go, some research for you. And I like the attack of the cello. Is it cello or double bass? I don't know. I like the attack of that as well.
Probably a cello, yeah.
Yeah, I like the way it's sort of like, it's an attack, isn't it? It's like being jabbed at, you know. Yeah, I remember this from the time. I liked it. I always liked it. I was really into Radiohead around sort of the Bends, OK Computer sort of period. And then I kind of lost interest a little bit, but... Yeah, that was the kind of time I was into Radiohead. But yeah, I was like this, and you know, again,
I really like how the video just looks so like mid to late 90s. It hurts. Is that how everyone made videos back then? In a room, you've got this room where then they just have like, you know, a one point for view, and it's very obviously like a box. You know, I don't know why everyone did that. Maybe it was just the sound stages they used or something. But all 90s videos look like that, which I love. It's, you know, I love a bit of nostalgia.
Some people didn't have the budget for a good video. They just had the budget for a good
song.
But
everyone did it, yeah. I think they must have still used the same soundstage at, like, Pinewood or something. I don't know. Everyone just turns out. They're in a queue around the block. Until James Bond turns up.
Emily, what are you saying?
I spent the first half of the 90s only listening to gangster rap and new metal.
Obviously.
And had a brief stint in the sort of Britpop arena before only listening to 60s psychedelic rock music. So I didn't hear this song at all at the time. And I think if I had, I missed the meeting. I think if it was a nostalgic song for me, I'd probably be weeping and swooning. But because I didn't, It's faultless. I'm not going to suggest that I've ever written a song as accomplished as this. I found it slightly grating.
Fair enough.
It's a bit too earnest for me. The vocal delivery is very, very earnest and serious.
I think he even did this in a break of recording OK Computer or something. And it's around about that time. So I'm not surprised he was in his...
It's funny, though, because it's funny you say that, because it's actually quite poppy for him as well.
Well,
but it's almost more like it's more like a Drugstore song with him on it, really. That's what it feels like, because I think it was. But it also, like Jim said, it doesn't sound like anything else they did, so it's a funny one, really. But it's funny because you say it's earnest, because maybe it's the subject matter, maybe they didn't feel, but she's quite got a bit of a twinkle in her eye, do you know what I mean? So it's funny that
maybe it doesn't really
fit with the rest of her stuff, you know. In a way.
I didn't catch that. But I only listened to it twice. It's brilliant. Everybody who's playing on it's great. Songwriter's great. Wouldn't reach for it in my nostalgic moments.
I mean, clearly I didn't reach for it for about 25 years.
No, I remember it. I do remember it, yeah. And it's another one of those examples of, like, again, tracks that you used, like... It reminded me a little bit of some of the PJ Harvey stuff as well she was doing with the cello and the double bass, you know, earlier.
Yeah.
Because it's got that strip-down quality, and then the cello and the double bass are kind of attacking, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. But, yeah, another example of 90s strings, yeah. good and bad. But, yeah, quite enjoy it. But I know what you mean. I can see what you mean. Although I feel like the chorus is almost like a little bit seasick, you know, a little bit queasy almost, like as if, you know, is it really? It's a bit of a dark humour about it, really. I know that it's literally about killing the president, but when they're singing it, is it really what they're thinking? I don't know, if that makes sense.
No, I know what you mean. I think there's an element of tongue-in-cheek.
I think their voices go quite well together, but then Tom York, he can be a bit earnest. He can be a bit too earnest.
Difficult sometimes to tell whether Tom York's being serious or not.
I know, yeah. That's the thing about him. he's quite pained, isn't he? Even on a fun song, which is this meant to be, isn't it? Really? In a way. It is. This is actually quite pop for him, isn't it?
Too much emotion, you know, like dial it back, bro.
Back, Tom, yeah.
I suppose when you're a teenager, really, it, probably me and Jim were really into it, weren't we, Jim?
So I remember watching it a lot. I remember liking it.
I mean the Bends as well. The
I'm like, who isn't? I'm the biggest Radiohead fan. That's what I meant. I just howled along to the Bends, and when you came out, it blew my tiny fucking mind.
I still do.
I was there at the time. I still do as well.
Yeah, yeah. Especially
McCarr. It's funny with the Bends. It's got like really chunky melodies and like guitars and everything. That is my favorite. But funnily enough, whenever you mention that, they're like, oh no, the Bends isn't their best album. So it's like, well, for me, it is.
It is for me.
It connects with me on a way none of their other stuff really does, personally. Or some of their songs, but, you know.
That's because we were 14 when it came
out. Yeah, that's there. Yeah, there is that. There's that nostalgia thing, isn't there? Definitely. We've talked about it before.
There is a nostalgia thing to it. But also, you know, I end up going back to albums that I didn't love in the 90s. And now I do, like, stuff like some of the things like The Long Pigs. Stuff like that. I really love that.
I go back and I think it sounds really weedy, like production.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's just not quite.
But in the 90s, in 1995, the Bends was just stuck on my CD player just over and over again. So it's one of them.
I've got to admit, it was probably Morning Glory that was stuck on my CD player.
But
I was 14. But then the Bends eventually usurped it by sort of 97, 98. Well, along with a load of other stuff. But yeah, I mean, with the Bends, you know, it's probably one of those albums that, as a 43-year-old, I'd probably give a 10 to.
Oh, yeah.
It is almost perfection, isn't it? So maybe it's not a 10. But it's pretty bloody close.
You should write in defence of the Bends, Jim. Because a lot of people go, oh, it's not their best. Oh, OK Computer, of course. Or Kid A, of course, that's their best album.
I thought you were going to say something else.
Stroking their chin.
People think Rainbows is their best album. Anyway. I won't go down there.
The kids, the BIM students who are so sweet, they all know the songs from the Bends and play and sing them in class, and it's delightful. So it is still big with at least this strata of young people.
Oh, good.
You were asking a question if it was Britpop as well, weren't you, Jim? I was saying, like, it's kind of adjacent to it because it was, you know, it was big at the time, but was it? It doesn't fit that, like, kind of Britpop sound to me, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like adjacent, yeah. And with the Bends, sorry, I'm interrupted again, carried away.
I don't think Britpop was a sound. I think it was a movement. So I think bands like Radiohead ended up being included in it because of what it was rather than how they sounded.
I think it's a bit of both, though. I think there's a bit of both on it. Because, yeah, it's a movement. But on the other hand, there's also very definitely after Blur and Oasis, there's like a lot of bands who try to kind of come on that bandwagon, you know? So. I don't know. I know what you mean. There's no definitive sound, but there is kind of a... Whereas Radiohead, and maybe Suede as well. Well, definitely Suede. And I've had this argument before, Pulp and the Manics as well. They're kind of more on a darker end and doing their own kind of thing. And they became part of it for a bit. Mm. You know, they were part of it, but they didn't like play into that, like, you know, waving the flag, you know, I don't know, British thing, you know, playing into the British thing. But I know what you mean. There's not like one definitive sound either, because it was just a made up term. It was just a made up term.
No, there are defining factors. There's the drums. Yeah. It's coming up with your tune, actually. There's a specific drum sound. There's a certain type of guitar move. There are strings, and there's very 60s influence.
Yeah. I said that to Jim, and he went, no. No, what I mean is like the original definition of Britpop doesn't really quite work, because it was trying to say that it's a long old discussion, isn't it? I agree. There are certain tropes of Britpop as a sound, but I think it's after Blur with Modern Life is Rubbish.
Yeah.
I think that kind of defined it. And then after that, there are certain, you're right, I think there are. But there's also, I said to Jim, it's like jingly jangly guitars sometimes as well, and character songs as well.
Yeah.
And Jim was like, no. So I don't know.
Right, okay. He's saying I said no here. But the thing is that Oasis weren't like that. Pearl Park like that. So I don't really think it is about jingly jangly guitars. And I think I don't think it is a sound, because anyone else is, you know, the way it's like saying these bands haven't decided. I think 80%, and especially the big ones, none of them decided to be part of Britpop. No. They're all co-opted into this ideal that it's a guitar band, British guitar band. Like I said, from like Modern Life is Rubbish-ish, maybe a bit before, you know, Dogman Star, Blah Blah Suede, and how they decided to like package this as it's the Brits coming back again, an antithesis to grunge, that it then became this umbrella for almost anyone, any man generally. I mean, a few women, you know, Louise Weller, blah, 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 Sonia in Echo Valley, but basically playing a guitar. And you're a British, and therefore you got co-opted into this Britpop concept. So, you know, like I say, I don't necessarily think there is this definitive sound. I mean, if you wanted to pass it between Blur, quintessentially English ideals, but more Southern English ideals.
No, there's not one, as I said, there's not one specific sound, but there are, like Emily said, there are certain tropes within a panoply of different things that you could say became Britpop, you know?
James is very commanding and mild anger on this subject. It's quite enjoyable. This is a wonderful subject, but I've been on this call for 2 hours.
Yeah. We need to crack on.
I could talk about it.
I know. It's a very much a 40-year-old bloke kind of discussion. Really. What is Britpop? But no, it's just, I don't know. I think there's a bit of both in it. I think there's a sound and a movement. But anyway, that's to sum it up.
Are we giving this one?
Oh, I'll give it an 8. Jim?
Yeah.
Oh, God. It's brilliant.
Be as mean as you like. It's fine.
Well, no, because actually I think it's faultlessly brilliant. I just don't like it. No,
but it's how you... Yeah, it's how you...
It's a arbitrary number that doesn't matter.
Fair enough.
And your classic, William?
Oh yeah. Okay, talking about Britpop. I think there's a bit of that there, but we'll get into it. This is Rialto and Monday Morning, 5:19. Lead singer Lewis. His name is Louis Elliott, or Lewis Elliott, however you want to put it. But basically, he was in a band called Kinky Machine, and because he told me because they wanted to do something a bit different, and they didn't have a keyboardist live, they just decided to like scrap all that and try and do something. But basically they're one of those bands who, like, a bit like Drugstore in a way, who got like mild touch of success in 1997 off the back of, like, they were compared to Pulp and Blur basically because of the suits and the sound. You know, they wore suits and they had a sound, but I wouldn't say they're exactly like Pulp or Blur, but they're in that stratosphere. But he told me that he was influenced by, obviously, Spectre, Barry, you know, John Barry, Barry White even, he said, which I didn't really hear on this one, but I've always liked this one because of the, well, he was talking about strings, you know what I mean? And he was saying growing up, he heard a lot of strings in his house and Barry White records, Spectre records. Like a lot of us of a certain age. But what I like about it, it's got that almost like 50s drive-in quality where there's a juxtaposition between the sort of doleful vocals, which are almost like spoken word, against this kind of spectre thing. But it's interesting because he also said that it wasn't done on, like, they didn't have an orchestra. They didn't have money for an orchestra. So it was done on a 16 track with a synth. And he said, actually, when they re-recorded it in Abbey Road, it didn't sound as good. So there's kind of an idea of, if you could do it on a 16 track where you have every track, you know what, Emily probably knows more about this than me because this is getting technical, but where you can like make every track good, you know what I mean? Or how you want it to sound. There's kind of an enclosed sound about that. And I do think it sounds quite good, even though it's done on synths and stuff. But it's obviously about a doom love affair, and you know, it's got this kind of widescreen production about it. But I suppose the most 90s thing about it that he told me as well is that they shopped the album around, they got signed, and then when they were just about to release, they had three singles, including this, that were doing quite well, and then they just got dropped by their label, and they had to find a new label. They found China Records, and then that record label got taken over by Warner's, that they used to be on. So it's like the most 90s story going. But they never quite had, you know, they never quite took off. And now he's in Grace Jones's live band and stuff like that. So, but I always really liked it. And it I suppose it's like an example of, you know, because I'm doing this piece about strings. It's an example of a song that was using strings, but it was integral to the, like, it was obviously a synth string, but it was sound. It was integral to their what they loved, rather than what he was talking about. Is a lot of bands around that time, they just bolted on strings as, like, you know, what should we put in the middle? Put some string section in. You know, it became popular, especially after Wonderwall, you know, and, you know, other examples I could give you. But what I like about this, kind of an affectionate to it, and a bit like Whitetown Your Woman is another one as well that got to number one off the back of samples of strings. That's another example as well. Anyway, yeah, long story short, I just think it fits into this category because it's like one of those tracks that people love, but they never really did anything, if that makes sense, because of various reasons. And also, like Emily says, there is very much a, in the slipstream of that kind of pulp sound, that kind of bedsit glamour, kitchen sink glamour thing, and a bit of Blur, but I just think they were doing their own thing, really. And what he said is he was influenced by what's his name from the Specials?
Terry Hall.
Terry Hall's solo stuff. Yeah, if you listen to that, he's very influenced by that as well, because it's more conversational. He said he was trying to avoid raucous tropes, which I quite appreciate, you know. So I suppose in a way, like, that kind of speaky, soundy thing is more cool now than it was in the late 90s. So. But the production, definitely, you know, this is within the era of This Is Hardcore and you know, a lot of that kind of sound. It was very much of that time. Like Emily said, it was a subset of Britpop. I know Jim says there's no sound, but I think there's several sounds myself. But all
don't
of them
open after, it up again.
All of them after Blur.
You agree
and
with
Oasis.
Me then?
No, all of them after Blur and Oasis. That's what I would say. Full stop. What do you think of it, Jim?
See, I don't remember it being particularly, I didn't really enjoy it at the time, and I haven't warmed to it since. I don't know. Like you said, if it's when they've like written the strings, but it's on a keyboard, and it kind of sounds it. It's a bit, I don't know, it's just a bit limp. I don't know, and I don't like his vocals at all. I'm sorry, I thought I'd listened to it a few more times. I hadn't listened to it for a little while until we, you know, and then this week, and my main thing about Rialto is that there was always a rumour that one of them was from where I'm from, Farnborough. But I've never been able to find any base, you know, evidence and truth behind that. But that was always kind of the thing about them. I don't know. He's quite a gadabout, isn't he, Louis Elliott? He's a Burberry model. He was a Burberry model. He toured like with quite a few big names. Grace Jones and Danny Goffey. And he's the cousin of Atticus Ross of Nine Inch Nails and the Oscar winning.
So what did you think of it, Jim? I think Emily wants to go. I can see her face.
Nah, not for me.
Not for you. Fair enough. Emily?
Jim's getting... This is real talk from Jim now. I wrote down aggressively 90s.
very nice.
It made me think of that Chris Morris satire of Pulp when they were called Blouse. Have you seen that?
Yes, yeah.
That is fucking hilarious. It was like, to me, because I didn't hear it at the time, it was like a parody, like an AI version of, like, how do we make something sound Britpop, actually? Let's not open that can of worms again. But it has all of the hallmarks. It's, again, it's like, oh, you know, you guys... These songs, and some, we had some other ones, didn't we? Suggested the other podcast. What can I say? You have good taste in great songwriters, which tends to skew quite 90s. And this is the most 90s one of all. It's, you know, it's a fucking great song. I just wished it was Jarvis.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
He would be, he's funny.
The thing is, I suppose the title of this thing is cult classic, so it's songs that people liked at the time.
I
take on board your criticism, because I definitely listen back to it. I'm like, yeah, maybe productionally it isn't as good as I remember, but I still enjoy it as that juxtaposition between something big and something quite down to earth, you know. But I know what you mean. Almost, it's very pulp. His and Hers probably does it much better, but.
I feel like it should have been a bit darker. It's about you know, the morning at 5:19, and it doesn't feel dark. It doesn't feel like.
But he does actually say it's about a relationship that somebody hasn't come home. You know, basically, it's the end. It's about a doomed love affair. You know, whatever.
Exactly.
Classic. But
Scott Walker did a lot of that, and there was always an undercurrent of sleaze with Scott Walker.
It's maybe a bit nice. I know what you mean. Yeah. That was like you said, sound of the time, you know.
Yeah.
I like it more than stuff that just like Embrace or whatever, that just like, you know, let's just chuck a string section on, you know.
Yeah.
But there you go. And I get the criticism, definitely do. I got affection for it though. And they've actually come back, so, which wouldn't surprise you.
Have they?
Yeah. But they never really had any hits. Even this was like, I think, top 30 or something.
Yeah.
But I like the tale, you know, it's a 90s tale, isn't it? Anyway, sorry, I'm prevaricating. I'll give it an 8. Do your worst, Jim.
I'll give it a 6. It's,
fair enough.
Yeah, I don't know. I like it almost like
for the Venice. Oh, for you. Fair enough. I get it.
It's a 7.
Oh, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
No hammer-ins on this.
Oh,
cool. So, what have you got coming up? Just briefly talk about that in 2 minutes. Emily?
What have I got coming up? I'm going to try and finish writing a song, although my brain is entirely corrupted by this podcast. That's what I'm going to start doing.
Sorry.
And then we're playing at, I've written it down, July 31st at the Forum in Tunbridge Wells.
Cool.
1st of August at the Boiler Room in Guildford, and the 2nd of August at Valley Fest. Yeah, come along.
Excellent.
Yeah,
well,
brilliant.
Cool.
And we're going to play out with one of your tracks. It's 1997, I believe. So what inspired this one before we play out with it? Just briefly.
It was I had the line greasy hair and heavy metal for ages, and I didn't know where to put it, but I knew that I liked it. And in the world of imperfect rhyme, the number 7 came up. This is, and then it just became a list of the objects and actions of being a teenager in the 90s, I left out a lot of the more gratuitous and revolting acts that happened. So I kept it vanilla for the kids. And that's it.
Cool. So
you've been listening to Show Me Magic, a God Is in the TV recommend show. Check out more on godisinthetvzine.co.uk. We're on our Twitter page, God Is in the TV. We're also on Facebook, God Is in the TV Zine, with a dot. Thanks for listening. Till the next time. Ta-da.